Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
And hello, listeners. Today's guest on the SBGAN podcast is Professor Dr. Mike Thompson, no P, Thompson, T-H-O-M-S-O-N, who needs no introduction as an expert in pediatric therapeutic endoscopy. Whoops. I guess that's him introduced then. Professor Thompson trained in Aberdeen. He's from Yorkshire, but he went north, way north, to learn medicine. And after 10 years knocking about in various junior posts in the United Kingdom, including a little jump to the side over to Brisbane, lucky guy, he was lured down south into the lair of the beast, that is to say, London. There at the Royal Free Hospital, he stayed for 10 more years, departing only to take up his present position in Sheffield. He offers for discussion today two articles and an essay on interventional endoscopy and pediatric gastrointestinal hemorrhage, titled Acute Upper Gastrointestinal Bleeding in Childhood, Development of the Sheffield Scoring System to Predict Need for Endoscopic Therapy. There is no excuse for mortality due to lack of competence and training of pediatric endoscopists in gastrointestinal bleeding therapy in 2018, and a management strategy for non-variceal gastrointestinal bleeding in children, an SBGAN position paper. Now, full bibliographic details are available in a précis on the SBGAN website, but I don't think that I'm out of line in noting here that the first author of each is a certain Thompson M. So endoscopy in practice is, of course, practical. One learns how to do it by doing it. Yet the lessons that practicing endoscopy teaches can be gathered, studied, and passed along to those less experienced at the trade in hopes of minimizing individual reinvention of the bicycle. When the day comes, dear listeners, that you must on your own glove up for an endoscopy in a child with hematemesis, then to have paid attention to this podcast, to have become familiar with Professor Thompson's writings, may prove useful indeed. You'll have a bicycle ready for you to step onto the pedals, and you can be confident that the bicycle beneath you is sturdily built, and in turn, that the ride ahead will not be disastrously wobbly. Mike, you've made endoscopy and gastrointestinal hemorrhage very much a central part of what you choose to tell us about what you've learned through the years in pediatric gastroenterology. How did that come to be the focus for your professional career, if I may call it that?
Great question, Alex. Thank you. I think, endoscopy was my focus. I've learnt it in Australia initially as a diagnostic procedure. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've tried to push the envelope towards therapeutic.
Yes.
Non-invasive, and trying to make the surgeon redundant, shall we say.
I am all for this, and I don't care who's listening.
and we've created a concept in SBGAN where we try to train, we try to make people aware of skills that they need to acquire to be able to deal with any eventuality in an emergency in pediatric endoscopy or GI bleeding. And this is one of my real focuses over the last 5 to 10 years.
Right enough, but then the question is, how are persons to acquire expertise in recognizing that endoscopy is the appropriate intervention or appropriate step in evaluation?
Thank you. So the big problem we have is threefold. Firstly, people don't recognize when a GI bleed is sufficient enough to require intervention. Secondly, they don't realize when they need to intervene. And thirdly, when they try to intervene, people in pediatrics, until more recently, have not had the required skills to be able to deal with the pathology that they're confronted with.
So let's take that step by step then.
Yes.
Okay. Your first point was recognition?
Yeah. So you need to recognize when a child is sufficiently unwell from a GI bleed. It's the last big emergency in pediatrics, I think, that we deal with badly. Mm-hmm. And if a child is shocked, if they have a large hematemesis or melena, or if they drop their hemoglobin significantly, then that's all part of what we call Sheffield that scoring system, which allows a child to reach a threshold for endoscopic intervention.
So, numbers?
So, we have a threshold of 8 out of 24 with a weighted scoring system, which is readily available in the bibliography that you mentioned. And if you surpass that number, then really the child should be going relatively quickly towards the endoscopy facility.
Should that scoring sheet be posted at the nurse's desk?
Thank you, Alex. That's a great point. We have a need for people to recognize when a child is having significant bleeding. And that might be, obviously, a need for resuscitation and then a need for transfusion. Or it may be that they're continuing to bleed, and then we have a situation where a child needs to more urgently move towards the endoscopy facility.
How does... I reckon my question now should be, then... You've got the endoscope in hand, and what skills do you need?
Great. Well, we make a distinction between non-variceal bleeding, as you will know, and variceal bleeding. If a child is already known to have varices, then that puts things in a different perspective, and then we have to have the banding kit around to enable us to do that. If it's when we do the endoscopy, a non-variceal bleed, like a gastric diffuse hemorrhage or a peptic ulcer or something like that, then there are different tools that we use. That threshold of competency has been lowered, by which I mean now we have spray-on devices like Hemospray and Puristat. And
unfortunately, you're going to have to explain those to me, because they were invented after they were invented after I left medical school.
Yeah, me too. In fact, they've only been around for the last 10 years. And whilst previously we'd use electricity, like electrocautery with mono and bipolar, or we'd use endoclips, which we still use, or over-the-scope clips, which are newer invention, we have other tools. And the other tools, which I just mentioned, something called Hemospray, which is a powder that we spray on to a bleeding area, are very useful for diffuse bleeding areas because they don't require a great deal of skill. It's just point and press, if you like.
I could work with that, even I. But that's diffuse bleeding as opposed to point source bleeding. I imagine that peptic ulcer disease would more frequently be point source.
Yeah, that's right. However, if you want to buy time, the surface-applied powders and gels are very effective at stopping point bleeding as well, even if it's in a spurting artery. Having done so, you can then apply a more conventional point source GI bleeding treatment, and that might be, as I mentioned, a hemostatic clip, or it may be a gold probe electrocautery.
Gold probe?
So gold probe is a device which has, at the end of it, a spiral little area of gold, and that allows current to be applied without putting a pad, an electrocautery pad, onto a patient. So it sets up a current within itself, and it goes down the biopsy channel, and then you can apply it directly to the area of interest and apply cautery current without needing a circuit to be set up with electrocautery pad.
Thank you, because all of these things, all of these terms that you're using, all of these products that you're invoking are, for me, forms of applied magic. Now, is there anything at use, is there anything in use nowadays that corresponds to 50 years ago's Blakemore Singstocken tube?
Yeah, so we used, well, certainly I'm old enough to remember using a Linton tube or a Singstocken tube, which we used to have to keep in the fridge to keep it rigid. And we did used to apply those. It really, again, is just buying you some time. We place those into the stomach and then have traction after a balloon is inflated in the stomach. And for varices, obviously, only for varices. Nowadays, because we can go forward quite quickly to endoscopy, and if you're in a center that has that capacity, then we tend not to use them so frequently.
Not so frequently. Then there's that caveat that you just brought up. If you happen to be in a center where these tools are available, will a parent whose child is vomiting blood is not going to know which center to take her daughter to?
Yeah, great point. So there's two things there. Firstly, it's my view that we should probably have 3 or 4 or maybe 5 centres in, for instance, in the UK, which allow excellence of care and then a child can be safely transported from a smaller hospital to a larger centre of excellence for that to happen. And usually you can temporise by using other measures such as octreotide and these sorts of things to get a child safely to one of those centres. And I guess the other thing to say is that, you know, if you are in extremis in a smaller hospital and you have an adult endoscopist who has these skills, then you can always talk to them and bring them into the fold in order to,
well,
to
clear,
create
clear.
A situation.
Yeah, you use the help that you have with the tools that you have. And one of those tools is a colleague in adult gastroenterology who knows what to do and how to do it. But your idea of centralizing whilst restricting pediatric endoscopy, has it found resonance in the United Kingdom?
It has, and after a large BPSU survey, we realised that the numbers of children in the UK, for instance, who have this problem, who require urgent endoscopic intervention, is not enormous. And that means that the people that are doing these procedures are therefore only subject, or they will only be encountering these children probably once every month or 2 months, and that's perhaps not sufficient to keep up your skills. And therefore, like everything, if you're doing it more often, you're going to get better at it, and that's going to be better for the patients.
No question about that. So, at least in the area of Sheffield, where you practice now, you must have been preaching this gospel at local feeder hospitals for some while. Have you seen changes in practice patterns?
Oh, yes, indeed. And that's mainly because people are aware of that. We've tried to spread the message more widely, and we are in conversation with NHS England and what they call the supra-regional approach, which will find resonance in other countries in Europe as well, in order that just like intestinal rehabilitation, you know, these kinds of really more rare conditions can be dealt with in situations in hospitals which have the capacity and the ability to do so.
Well, I don't know exactly how that will work, but it seems like a practical and reasonable thing to do if you have the helicopter, the air evacuation services and things of that sort available, yes? I live in Hungary, and I imagine that stabilization of a child in Szombathely, the local county town, with a rapid transfer to Budapest would be the way to go. But how do you convince health authorities that indeed this makes sense?
Great question. And that's one of the things that we as doctors have to try and portray as a common sense approach. And using the statistics of the children that survive and do well when they're transferred to a centre of excellence compared with those that aren't is the focus of that argument. And it's a good argument. It holds water.
Well, it's a good argument, but I'm going to come back to the idea of what are the numbers?
The numbers are not great. So we would be having probably 400 to 500 of these cases in the UK at any one time. And there are, quite apart from the other issue which we need to talk about, which is button batteries presenting with major hematemesis, there are children who die unnecessarily and in situations where the district general hospital, the small hospital, hasn't recognised that they need urgent intervention. And whilst those aren't common, the possibility of that happening more frequently if the situation is not centralised is certainly one argument that is something we make regularly. And we have cases anecdotally where that has happened, unfortunately. Less so now, because people are more aware of getting a child to a centre where the skills are available. But it does still happen, unfortunately.
Now we come to what you've just mentioned, which is button battery ingestion as a cause for hematemesis and for much more. How are things progressing in that line?
It's a great question. So button batteries, as we all know, are an evil invention in terms of the problem for children, because when they've stopped working in a device, they're left around and they still have sufficient charge to then cause significant damage within 2 hours of ingestion. And in toddlers, where they get stuck at where the artery, the aorta crosses the esophagus and the mid-esophagus, especially for the larger batteries, they can erode through the esophagus into the aorta within 2 hours.
Jeepers creepers, 2 hours into the aorta, and
it's a very, very important thing to recognize. And I think most of us in this place in Espagan recognize that, but many people outside this excellent institution don't understand how quickly these problems can occur. We've got one major advance recently, and that is that Energizer, one of the Button battery companies, have just produced a battery which is covered with titanium. Now, that means that when it's ingested by a child, it doesn't produce current. That's going to cost about €1 more per pack of four than previously, but it means that in due course, over the next 5 to 10 years, when the old batteries get phased out and then this new battery gets phased in, hopefully this problem will be something of the past.
Thank you for that. I had no idea that that had taken place.
It's only occurred in the last month.
Then I don't feel so bad about being ignorant. And I imagine that the news will be new to some of the listeners as well.
I think it probably will. And it's a fantastic development.
And will it be followed, made a standard for other companies?
Yes, I'm sure that they will follow suit. The problem will be economics, as it always is.
Economics and, well, what's the difference? And I'm trying to save a little bit of money here, and I'm ordering some batteries over Amazon, and so it'll be a while before stocks are depleted.
It'll be regulation, I think, is what takes
that's
it forward.
That's what does it. In order to make certain that these are that the precursors, the damaging ones, what did you call them, the tools of Satan?
Yes.
Are withdrawn from the market. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what else would you like to tell us about gastrointestinal hemorrhage in kids and how to deal with it?
So endoscopy is my thing, obviously, and teaching people to do it properly is the way forward. So I'd like to just say, you know, we have lots of fantastic ESPGAN fellowships. We have hands-on courses here at ESPGAN. We have the Endoscopy Learning Zone. And we have lots of hands-on courses, specific monothematic courses for GI bleeding, which are available on the webpage. And they're fantastic because you do need to be aware of the skills. But the other thing I would probably point out is that endoscopy is the end point of this. You need to be able to know what to do with a child when they present. So things like high-dose IV PPI therapy, intravenous octreotide or giving terlipressin, and stabilizing a child. So standard medical procedures before endoscopy are really important to be aware of.
And to be ready to use them, to know the tools that you have in your armamentarium.
Absolutely.
And to be ready to deploy them. Sir, thank you very much for your time today. Before we end this recording session, though, I need to ask you as a Yorkshire lad, as a Yorkshire lad from Harrogate, what would you like to recommend to our listeners that they look for as your contribution to the ESPGAN podcast song repository?
Okay. So I'm going to go with one song which always relaxes me and gives me a positive attitude to life, which is Three Little Birds by Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Thank you again.
Thank you.